Thank you very much, Steve. I'd like to start with a slide that you've seen actually in the previous two presentations. This is a slide where each red dot represents 1,000 deaths from pneumonia. So you've seen this with severe gastroenteritis, you've seen this with measles, and it looks very similar. And I think it's important to look at this slide and remember it as we go through the talk. You can see that pneumonia does have a big burden globally, and that a lot of the burden is in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia. And if you compare pneumonia with some of the other leading infectious disease killers worldwide, you'll see that it is one of the leading causes of death, both in children under 5, which is the yellow bars, and in children that are over 5 in adults, which are the red bars on this graph. And when you compare this to some of the other major causes of death, such as HIV and AIDS, diarrhea, malaria, and measles, for example, a lot of people had not realized until they had started to compare these side by side that pneumonia was one of the leading causes of death. Because of that, WHO came out a few years ago with a campaign, in a way, to remind people that pneumonia was the forgotten killer of children. And along with that, they were looking at ways to reduce this burden of pneumonia worldwide. This shows a framework that WHO helped develop with a bunch of subject matter experts around the world to reduce mortality and morbidity from pneumonia. You can see in the upper left that one of the ways to do this was to protect children by providing a healthy environment. That included promoting breastfeeding and improving the environment through hand washing and reducing air pollution. At the bottom, you'll see that one way was to treat children who do become ill with pneumonia through making sure that they have access to antibiotics and other supportive care like oxygen. But what we're going to focus on in this talk is the upper right, and that's really preventing children from becoming ill with pneumonia in the first place. And certainly one of the major ways that we can do that is with vaccination. Vaccination against measles, pertussis, Streptococcus pneumonia, or Hib. So I'd like to talk in this presentation about Streptococcus pneumonia. This is a micrograph of the diplococcus, which is strep pneumonia. And on this next slide, I'd just like to show just a graphic. This is important to understand how the vaccines work. So around the diplococcus is a capsule. And so this is a sugar. And there are many different capsules, over 90 of them, that cause the different serotypes of pneumococcus. This is important because right now the vaccines that we have available, and this is something that we talked about a little bit in the rotavirus presentation, the vaccines only fight certain serotypes, not all of them. So pneumococcal conjugate vaccines have been used in the United States since 2000. We were the first country to introduce one of these, and we introduced the 7-valent vaccine into the routine immunization program at that time. And then many of you would know that the 13-valent was just introduced a few weeks ago and is starting to filter into clinics around the country. The 7-valent vaccine is so called because it includes 7 of these serotypes or antigens to these serotypes in it. And those are 4, 6B, 9V, 14, 18C, 19F, and 23F. You don't need to remember those, but I think that it's important to think of what's now covered in the 13-valent, and there are 6 extra serotypes that are included in that. In particular, I'd call your attention to serotype 19A, which will be important later on in the talk. These vaccines are conjugated to a diphtheria toxin, CRM-187, and that makes them relatively more immunogenic in young children, so they can be given to infants where a lot of the disease is. And even the 7-valent vaccine had pretty good serotype coverage in North America and Australia, and relatively good coverage in other countries around the world. So even though these vaccines only included a small number of the 90 serotypes, they still were able to present a lot of pneumococcal disease in most countries. So there are 2 vaccines that have been used in the United States, the 7-valent and then the 13-valent that's being replaced. This slide just shows you a little bit of the pneumococcal vaccine pipeline, which is important when you look outside of the United States. So at the far right are the three vaccines that have been launched and are licensed in some countries worldwide, the 7-valent and the 13-valent, which were both are both produced by the same manufacturer, and then the 10-valent vaccine that is produced by another manufacturer. But you can see, as you look along this slide from the preclinical stage to phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials, there are a number of vaccines that are in the pipeline from a number of manufacturers, as well as some that you can see. Unfortunately, the discontinued color didn't go through, but many of those vaccines under clinical phase three trials are now discontinued, such as the 9-valent and the 11-valent. We did just learn at a pneumococcal meeting a few weeks ago that there's a 15-valent that's in production right now. And you'll see under the phase one trials, what's very exciting are some of these common protein vaccines, where they're trying to find an antigen that is not specific to certain serotypes, but would prevent all pneumococcal disease instead of just a few serotypes. So what's good about having a lot of data from the United States, because we had introduced early on, is that we can see what happens with pneumococcal disease over a number of years, at least in an industrialized country. So this is a slide where I'd like to put on some surveillance data from our pneumococcal surveillance in the United States through the Active Bacterial Core Surveillance System, which is a multi-state active population-based surveillance. This first line is the overall levels of pneumococcal disease. And you can see in the first 2 years before PCV7, or the 7-valent pneumococcal vaccine, was introduced, 1998, levels were relatively high, 100 cases per 100,000 of the population. After the vaccine was introduced, the levels dropped dramatically and have stayed very low up until 2008, which is the most recent data that we have available. If you look at the serotypes that are included in the 7-valent vaccine, you can see that they've been nearly eliminated. So in the United States, those comprised most of the pneumococcal disease that we had. And what's been great to see is how that's just disappeared and has stayed very low many years after the vaccine was introduced. And so it was about an 80% decline in all pneumococcal disease and about a 99% decline in the serotypes just included in the vaccine. But to bring back to the beginning, you know, we do care about the impact on pneumococcal disease, but really the burden is with pneumonia. And so this was an elegant study that was published in The Lancet a few years ago, looking at data from the nationwide inpatient sample, and that showed that the rates of all-cause pneumonia dropped 39% from before PCV7 to after PCV7 was introduced, and that pneumococcal pneumonia dropped 65%, and this is both in children under 2. The graphs to the left, just to explain them a little bit, the blue dots show the seasonal variation in pneumonia, because certainly pneumonia is more of a common disease in the winter months. The red line is sort of a smooth version. And so you can see on the left the level of pneumonia that was seen before vaccine, and then on the right how that's dropped. So we have good data from the US, at least, showing that both invasive pneumococcal disease declines pretty dramatically after the vaccine is introduced. But you can also see impacts on pneumonia as a broader syndrome, which suggests that a lot of pneumonia that we see, at least in the US, is caused by pneumococcus. This is a busy slide, and I don't expect people to read it, but this summarizes the 5 major clinical trials that have been done with PCV7. There were 2 in the United States, 1 in South Africa, 1 in the Gambia, and 1 in the Philippines. And many of these trials both looked at the impact of the vaccine on pneumonia as well as on invasive pneumococcal disease. And in general, what's nice to see is that at least in a trial setting, we see very similar things to what we found in the United States after the vaccine was introduced. The vaccines have been uniformly very effective against vaccine-type invasive disease, and they have had about a 20% effectiveness against pneumonia, whether it was confirmed by an X-ray or not. And this is across a number of settings around the world. What we don't have at this time, and I think is one of the challenges, is the effectiveness data from countries that have introduced this vaccine, because the vaccine is really not used that widely yet globally. So we have a lot of good news from the US and from these clinical trials. But you'll notice there's an extra line that's been added to this graph, and this is the blue one. This is the serotype 19A that I mentioned earlier. And even though the decline in the US has been pretty sustained over the past few years, there is a serotype that seems to be replacing the serotypes that have been removed. And 19A has generally been increasing in the US over the past few years. This is a highly antibiotic resistant strain, and it's something that we're concerned about because the concern is that it might actually overtake some of the declines that we have seen with the vaccine. The good news is that the 13 valent that's been introduced includes that, so we're assuming that that's going to push that down again. We don't know if some other serotype might pop up in its place, but right now at least we're happy that the 13 valent has finally come along. And this is concerning data that came out of some folks that had done work in Alaska, and some folks may have seen this. The red line on this shows the decline in PCV7 type disease from 1995 to 2000, which is before the vaccine, through 2006. And you can see once again, as we'd seen in the United States and as we've seen in other countries, that there was a beautiful and sustained decline in that disease. What's different about what was found in this small region in Alaska is that the disease caused by serotypes not included in the vaccine, which is the yellow line, increased to levels that were even higher than what we'd seen before the vaccine was introduced. So unfortunately, by 2006, in this area of Alaska, there was as much pneumococcal disease after the vaccine had been introduced compared to before. And a lot of this is because of vaccine types such as 19A. They're going to be introducing the 13 valent vaccine. They have actually already and are watching the declines come down, but it remains to be seen how effective that will be in tamping down the disease in this area. And this is concerning globally because really the data that we have is from mostly developed countries. And some of this area in Alaska is often is a little bit more like what a low-income country might be. It's an indigenous population, it's generally a poor population. So many countries are concerned that they may see similar things to this, where the vaccine declines initially and then climbs up again. And there's even some data from the United Kingdom that suggests that they may not have had as sustained declines as we've seen in the United States. We're currently working with them to compare our surveillance with theirs to understand what might be causing that. So I think that there's other things that have happened with pneumococcal disease that were nice surprises. And most of the folks in this audience at this conference know about herd immunity or indirect effects. But very briefly, if you have, for example, a herd of cattle and you have the diplococcus, you can see how it's spread throughout the herd pretty quickly. And if you immunize just some of the cattle, you can stop that spread. And this is a slide from our same active bacterial core surveillance in the United States, showing what's happened in adults who do not get the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. And you can see that there has been pretty significant declines in most age groups in adults that has been because of the herd effects of the vaccine. So this has been very encouraging for other countries to see that they may be able to immunize their children and also see a reduction in pneumococcal disease in adults. This is particularly important in many parts of Africa because when there's high rates of HIV infection among young adults, they see relatively high rates of pneumococcal disease. And here in the United States, we found that even among HIV-infected adults, there has also been a nice decline among pneumococcal disease due to the PCV7 introduction in children. So similar to with rotavirus, there is a recommendation from the World Health Organization from 2007 that recommended that pneumococcal conjugate vaccine be used in most countries, particularly countries with a high rate of pneumococcal disease or with high HIV infection or prevalence, should prioritize introducing this vaccine into their routine immunization system. But that's certainly more easily said than done. And so what's been encouraging with pneumococcal conjugate vaccine is that there are at least a couple mechanisms to get this relatively expensive vaccine out into some of the poor countries where disease is. The Gavi Alliance is an alliance of a number of different governmental and non-governmental organizations that basically take money and help subsidize vaccine introduction for the world's poorest countries. And this makes a vaccine, you know, that can be upwards of $100 US per dose, and makes it so that a country could pay, you know, closer to just a quarter per dose. And even though that's an extremely dramatic reduction in the price, it's still relatively high for many of these countries. So does this sort of subsidy work? This is data from Hib vaccine. Really, when the Gavi Alliance first came about in 2000, the main vaccine that they were subsidizing was Hib. You can see here that back in 1991, a small percentage of countries worldwide were using the vaccine. The bars on this graph are the percent of countries that have introduced, and then the lines show the percent of the birth cohort that have either received or have access to the vaccine. And what's dramatic about this slide is that really it has only been in the past couple years, and particularly since 2000, when the Gavi Alliance started subsidizing vaccine, that a lot of the gains have been made with Hib vaccine. And you can divide this same slide up, and I've truncated the right side of this slide, and divided it by income level of the country. So the top line on this slide is the percentage of high-income countries that have introduced the vaccine, and you can see they were the first to introduce because they could afford it, and they've had pretty high levels of coverage for many years. As you march across this slide, these are upper middle income, lower middle income, and then lower income countries that have introduced the vaccine. And as you can expect, the poorer the country, the slower they are to introduce the vaccine. What's interesting is what's happened in the past couple years. So if you look at that bottom line, that's lower income countries, and those are generally the countries that can introduce the vaccine with Gavi support. We've now actually seen that those poorer countries, the poorest countries of the world, have the same percentage of them have introduced Hib vaccine as upper income countries and upper middle income countries. And the group that's now lagging behind are lower middle income countries that face many of the same challenges as these Gavi-eligible low-income countries, but still don't necessarily have the resources to introduce the vaccine on their own. There's another financing mechanism, in addition to subsidies from the Gavi Alliance, that has been developed for use with pneumococcal vaccine that will hopefully be spread to other new vaccines, and it's called an AMC, or an Advanced Market Commitment. This is an upfront financial commitment by donors that will subsidize the purchase of vaccines at a set price if and when a vaccine meets a minimum specified criteria and is demanded by an eligible country. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but what it basically means is that if vaccine companies will develop a vaccine that, for example, could be used in some of these poor countries, they can pay it, they can sell it at a high price where it will be subsidized for a certain number of years, at which point they agree to sell it at a lower price, for example, $3.50 per dose or somewhere around there. And so this is something that's going to be used over the next few years to both have countries and manufacturers make the vaccine and then to get it into some of the poorer countries at a much less expensive dose, much less expensive price. I'd like to end with a slide that shows sort of where we are with pneumococcal vaccine use in the world. And if you remember from the original slide that shows where the burden of pneumonia is, which is a proxy for the burden of pneumococcal disease, you can see that the vaccine's not quite used in the right places yet. Most of the burden of pneumococcal disease and pneumonia is in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia. And the different colors, since you may not be able to read them, the blue countries are ones that have introduced the vaccine, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, and have it in widespread or universal use. The green countries are countries that use it in high-risk groups, such as children with HIV or other underlying conditions. So really, those are the countries that have introduced the vaccine, and you can see that it's primarily North America, South America, Europe, some of the Middle East, and Australia. These are not the high-burden countries of the world. What's been great to see is that just over the past year, it is starting to filter into some of the poorer countries, and it's doing it much sooner than something like Hib vaccine did. So there are now three countries in Africa that have introduced the vaccine, and two of them are low-income countries. The Gambia and Rwanda introduced through the Gavi Alliance, and then South Africa, which although it's a middle-income country, still has some parts that are very poor, has also introduced the vaccine. And you can notice from the other colors, which are these yellow and magenta colors, these are countries that have applied to Gavi to use the vaccine, or that actually have received approval from Gavi to introduce the vaccine and just haven't yet. So I think over the next few years, we'll be able to see pneumococcal conjugate vaccine getting into countries that need it most, much quicker than we saw with other vaccines like Hib or even hepatitis B. So where are we now? We've had a number of successes and challenges. The vaccine has been shown to be effective in a number of settings. However, most of them are high-income countries. And the impact has been seen both in children and in adults. And as you saw with the pipeline, there are multiple vaccines that are currently available with new financing mechanisms that will help get that vaccine to children that need it most. But there are certainly a number of challenges. At this point, we really don't know what the effectiveness of these vaccines is in low-income countries. And many of these countries try to use different vaccination schedules because it's such an expensive vaccine, and we don't know how well those work. There are also concerns about replacement disease and herd effects in non-industrialized countries where the burden of disease is much higher and where the vaccine coverage may not be as high. And financing is certainly still an issue, particularly for middle-income countries where even with Hib vaccine, they're currently lagging behind. Thank you very much.